This talk was given by Danica Shoan Ankeli at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shoan is a senior monastic in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
May the precious bodhicitta arise where it has not arisen. And where it has arisen, may it not diminish, but increase further and further. This is an aspiration prayer. I think it's quite common in Tibetan schools of practice, and it's traceable back to Nagarjuna, so coming up on 2,000 years ago. Our aspiration, our bodhicitta, the mind that seeks to wake up, the heart that seeks enlightenment. Enlightenment for ourself, so that we can really know who we are. And for the benefit of all beings in this world full of suffering. Without bodhicitta, there's no awakening. There is no transformation. There is no bodhisattva path. There's no freedom from suffering. So it is indeed precious. I think it's safe to say that those of us who find our way to Rahat Sushitin, the spirit of bodhicitta is alive and well, even if it's on low simmer. You don't get here without a calling to wake up. And however you might think of that to yourself, you know, that seeking mind and heart. Yesterday, Yunin talked about, you know, wanting to meet reality. We might think in terms of wanting real freedom or to know what's true or to meet God, Goddess, to find peace of mind or enlightenment. And it's so very fundamental to our path. You know, it is, in fact, what the Guardian Council is listening for glimmers of when someone comes forward to want to be a student. It's what Monastic Council is listening for when someone asks to step into monastic training. When someone calls and wants to spend time in residency here and there's a phone interview, that too is in there. What's this person coming for? Why? Even just to come to session for the first time. It's that trust. We have to have some trust that there is an experience possible that's beyond this suffering saha world, and that that experience is for us. We have to believe at least a little bit that it's possible for us. And that we are going to discover it. So in this aspiration prayer, there is... May the precious bodhicitta arise where it has not arisen. And I think of that, you know, I mean, I imagine that this prayer could be understood in so many ways, but I take it very personally. So in me, you know, where is it that that aspiration to wake up hasn't yet come into bloom? Where have I put up a wall? What am I not seeing? What am I leaving out? Or am I just tired, fatigued with myself? And where it has arisen, may it not diminish, but increase further and further. And bodhicitta is so potent that you really only need just a spark. If you have just a spark, it's enough. It's enough. It can catch. It makes me think of that story that I think Shugen Roshi mentioned recently, and I've heard before over the years because it's so good, about a student asking Yasutani Roshi, you know, how much sincerity do I need to manifest in order to realize in myself and wake up? Like 80%, 95%, like 99% sincerity? And Yasutani Roshi said, maybe 1%. And this piece that we're seeking our realization for the benefit of all beings, I think sometimes that can feel distant. You know, we can think, well, that's great, but I did come here to kind of address my own suffering. But I think that if we look closer, we see all those other beings are actually really, really, really close. That our suffering is so tied to the suffering of the world. And that if you could somehow imagine a world in which every other being was happy and peaceful and at ease, like, wouldn't your suffering be gone, really? So I was recently, a couple months ago, at a retreat at the Garrison Center called Confusion Dawns as Wisdom with a Tibetan teacher, Sotni Rinpoche. And this is where I heard this aspiration prayer. And they didn't have it, you know. Garrison is a retreat center. It's not a monastery, and it's not necessarily a Buddhist center, although they do seem to host quite a number of Buddhist retreats. So kind of stepping into that, I was just kind of soaking the whole thing up, and I wanted to bring some of what I has stayed with me, some of what has stayed with me from that, and to share it. But one of the things that I appreciated and kind of came away with was like, oh, bodhicitta is like such a big part of the teaching and practice there. And every day before the teaching started, we would, you know, do some chanting and take refuge and arouse the bodhicitta aspiration. And we would chant this, and then Sogni Rinpoche would do some lineage, sort of invoking of the lineage masters in Tibetan. I really loved that part. I think the Tibetan language just sounds so cool. And then he would say something, and he had a translator. He would say this thing in Tibetan, and then his translator would translate it and say, please form the altruistic motivation of bodhicitta. And in that spirit, please listen to the teachings. And that was how every block of teaching, there was a block of teaching in the morning and in the afternoon for about a week, 5 days or so. And that was how they all started, and it became kind of my favorite part. And, you know, I said to a couple of people that I was so struck by, you know, the emphasis on bodhicitta. And then I started to pay a little more attention to things that we do here all the time. And working on this talk, I was paying more attention just to sort of the liturgy that holds sesshin in place. And I really was realizing, I was like, oh my God, it's all like raising bodhicitta, raising bodhicitta, raising bodhicitta, like again and again and again. Like, how have I not seen that? You know, I mean, beginning with Canton, where the checking rounds, where Roshi comes through the zendo and everybody puts their hands in gassho. And the monitor seat is a kind of a beautiful spot to take that in from, because you just see it go like in a wave down each row. You know, and here we are in this room, so many people, 98 or whatever it is, and person after person, you can feel like, okay, you know, and whatever you may be feeling in the privacy of your own body, heart, and mind at that early hour, as the teacher comes by, it's like, okay, yes, I'm ready. And then we roll into, you know, the verse of the Kesa to end the morning sitting practice. I mean, that's just completely bodhicitta aspiration. Vast is the robe of liberation, a formless field of benefaction. I wear the Tathagata's teachings, saving all sentient beings. And if you start to pay attention, it's like, you know, the bows that we do in service. I remember years ago having that described as this gesture as raising the Bodhi mind. And you can really feel that. You know, I'm sure there are many different ways to experience a prostration, but that one seems alive to me. At the end of every chant, may we realize the Buddha way together. Together, then everyone comes in, whoosh, all those voices, all Buddhas, all Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, everybody through space and time. It's like bodhicitta fest. Orioki, may we be relieved from self-clinging with all sentient beings. We eat to stop all evil, to practice good. So, you know, it's completely part of our every practice opportunity, because it's true. It's really showing us something about waking up and who we are. And because our suffering comes from our fixation and our misunderstanding about who we are, it's good to like loosen that, you know. We're constantly consumed with me, 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 me. So we have a lot of reminders to be like, it's not just about you, actually. At all. Or not in the way that you think. Maybe that's more accurate. One of the things that I appreciated about this, the teachings and the teacher at this retreat, you know, he is, Sokni Rinpoche is a teacher in the Kagyu tradition, and he is the son of Tulku Urgyen Rinpoche, who is like one of the great meditation masters of the 20th century, at least that we are widely aware of here in the West. And these teachings of Dzogchen and Mahamudra, which are very, very, very much Zen teachings, very similar, because they're teachings about using your mind, using mind to see into mind, and they're meditation-based traditions. One of the things that I appreciated is that in all of his years of teaching, he travels around the world. He doesn't have a center like this that's a home base, but he really travels quite widely and teaches in retreat settings like the one that I was at. But one of the things that really struck me is how he started. And he started by having everyone relax And he like had us all like shake, you know, like that. I won't make you do it now. I thought of doing that. And drop. He would be like, okay, now drop. Be like, do it again, do it again. You'd have to, and he talked about how, you know, we're holding life so tightly. We're holding our experience so tightly, and we need to loosen that. And he had a tissue, and he just crumpled it up. This is how we're holding our life. And when we got to the teachings on bodhicitta, as they came in, he asked us to kind of bring forward a feeling of warmth in our heart, and to be aware of the being in this room with all these other people. And I thought that was really, I needed to be reminded, you know. It's like, here we all are, people of the way. You know, you're sitting next to someone who's like really working to realize themselves. Like, that's incredible. That's so moving. Can we bring forward a feeling of warmth in our heart just for each other in our practice lives? To want happiness for each other. A number of years ago, when Chosen Roshi was here, she talked about, I guess, bodhicitta in some way, and she was saying, you know, she had a practice of going around the zendo and saying to herself, you know, may so and so realize themselves even before I do. So it'd be like, you know, may Vito realize himself even before I do. May Camille realize herself even before I do. May Yana realize herself even before I do. Each person. And to really like take that in. What are we saying when we say that? So this bodhicitta aspiration is a practice of non-fixation. And for me, this session, non-fixation, has been sort of one of my key words and phrases that I like have to reintroduce to myself to help myself stay alive in my own practice. Non-fixation, you know, finding the openness that's inherent in reality, but we fix it. In Roshi's opening words to the session, when he spoke about cocoon, that's like a very visual way of speaking about like fixing, you know, containing, holding, as opposed to what the teachings say reality actually is, which is like open and fluid always and empty. Whatever that actually means. Traleg Rinpoche wrote, We no longer see the things of the world as having enduring essence. This is awakening, an awakened mind. We no longer see the things of the world as having enduring essence. We see that things arise as they do out of codependent origination. We have anger, fear, grasping, craving, because we are trying to freeze the world. If we can see everything as dependent origination, we will see everything as a process. Nothing is fixed except for our concepts and ideas. So practice helps us begin to shift our view, to see into our cocoon or out to meet its edges and feel like, oh, it's actually really uncomfortable in here. In a cozy, sick, twisted way. And to begin to recognize, you know, that beautiful phrase in the teachings, the magical display. Reality is a magical display, like, you know, like the reality is a being woven. There are those, you know, ancient stories of like the weaver at their loom, like weaving the world into being, and we are doing that, but we don't know it. And we can train our minds so that we're using that capacity so that what we're weaving is really generous and beautiful and meaningful and helpful. Or we can weave a hell realm. So we have a self, you know, that does manifest. We're not actually trying to get rid of that. We're just trying to understand it correctly, to recognize it as something woven on the loom of our consciousness, a thread that you can pull and it just goes nothing. Sobni Rinpoche has this phrase that he uses called beautiful monsters as a way of speaking about those kind of habitual aspects of ourselves, the karmically imprinted, our selfhood as it arises in its, you know, various forms. And I keep picturing like Muppet-style monsters. I don't know what... What kind of monster comes to your mind if you think about like your self creation aspect as a monster? But I'm picturing like, you know, that kind of Muppet fur. So it's like, you know, to know what kind of monster you have. Is your monster like really quick to blame? I didn't do it. It's his fault. Is your monster someone who's afraid of confrontation? Maybe your monster's really uptight and rigid about how they do things. If they can get everything just right, then it'll be okay. Don't move that, please. Is our monster defensive? Maybe our monster seems like they don't really care about anything. It's just a defense. Or a real overachiever that hopes that by like doing everything right, then they'll finally get that sense of love they're longing for. Or is our monster just quaking with fear? So Sogni Rinpoche would say like, you know, don't think she's like that. Think her monster is like that. Starting to make a little bit of room there on how we identify things. And again, the point isn't to like eliminate the monster and all of its so-called flaws. It's just like shifting our view, warming up our heart a little bit. And this is really, really critical for bodhicitta. We have to have a sense of love for ourselves that we can kind of start to relax into. And we can develop that. Practice, I think, is great for developing that. You know, I remember, and we may or may not, you know, be aware of like what our relationship is to ourselves. I remember years ago, early in training, Daito Roshi did Dharma Encounter, and I went up in Dharma Encounter. That's like kind of like a public doksan. And I really don't remember like what the subject was or what he asked or what I said. I only remember what he said in response was basically like, you've got to stop. What was it? It was like, you've got to stop telling yourself that you're a piece of shit. I was like, wait, what? Like, I don't think that. Like, what are you even talking about? I don't think I said that. I probably just said, thank you for your teaching. But in my mind, I was like really like disturbed. And then I remember like going home that night, you know, back to our apartment in the city. And like, you know, like when something gets under your skin and you've just like got to talk about it, I was like talking to Gokhan about it. And like, I don't know why he would say that. And I don't think this. And da, 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 da. And it went on like that. And then somehow, you know, not long, I don't know, a day or so later, it started to land. And I started to see like, oh, I do think I'm a piece of shit. You know, I covered it over. And seeing that, I could start to release it. After Sogni Rinpoche had us relax, the first kind of teaching that he offered was on what he calls essence love. And something about that, I was just like, that is such a weird grammatical structure, essence love. Like, it was sort of like, huh? But, you know, I put aside my resistance to it. I'm sure it was just ordinary old resistance. And basically, he was talking about, you know, that sense, what Daido Shi used to say, you know, you're perfect and complete, lacking nothing. And I used that in my dark hours on the cushion when I would feel like a total basket case. And I thought, he is saying that, and he is saying it like it's true. So what does that mean right now? So Zazen becomes this place of learning how to open to our experience. And this is so critical and hard. In a way, practice is not that complicated, actually, at all, but it's very, very subtle. It's very, very subtle, and that makes it very, very hard to see ourselves and to be with ourselves. And when we get an instruction like, you know, just be with your experience, don't suppress, don't indulge, don't ignore, don't try to escape it, just be with it. It's like, how do you do that? It's, you have to figure that out. You have to figure that out. And you figure it out by working with it and trusting the teachings and working with the teacher. And I will just take this opportunity to say, I think it's really important to go to face-to-face teaching every day in session, even if you don't feel like it. Because you don't know what's going to come up if you put yourself in front of a relational situation with someone who has walked this path and who can see you more clearly, usually, than you can see yourself. And can help you find your way in these very subtle, difficult realms. So after essence love, he offered this practice, which sounds very like I don't know, kind of user friendly. He calls it handshake practice. But when I was taking it in and like, you know, practicing it in the room, I mean, I was like, oh, wait, this is actually like really an advanced meditation practice. It's basically what I just said, you know, it's the same kind of instruction that we receive here all the time, that you're meeting whatever arises in your mind, you're meeting it. And so the handshake comes in. This is my understanding, subject to error, because I was, you know, just at this one retreat. But you're taking the hand of your feeling world and letting the hand of the thinking mind meet it. It's basically an awareness practice, like really be aware and don't mess with it. Don't try and fix it. Just be with it. Just be with it. And so what we see when we can actually be with our experience is that our experience is not fixed. That we are creating, when we're stuck in that, that's our own mind is in an active role. I asked Shugen Roshi in a retreat not that long ago, I don't know, maybe it was a little while ago, within the last year, you know, why is there so much emphasis on Zen in staying with difficult experiences? And somehow in the retreat, it had come up like you're going to be with the barrier or be with whatever's arising in your Zazen. Like, why is there so much emphasis on that? And he looked at me and he said, is this a setup? By which I understood that to mean like, oh, I'm supposed to know the answer. I was like, no, it's not a setup. I'm genuinely asking. So, you know, it's because when we can just be and we're not messing, that's when things can shift. Right? That's how we actually start to encounter the emptiness of phenomena and of ourself. But we're so ingrained to go in there and mess around, or I shouldn't, or I really what I want is to be feeling. Uh-uh. Stop. And this is why I thought, you know, the handshake practice seemed like very challenging. Because if you're feeling filled with like fear or grief, to just be with that, that's so hard. That is so hard. So you give rise to bodhicitta, and you draw on the strength and the example of all the people in this room and all the Buddhas through space and time who have been there, who are telling you it's okay. You can just be with that feeling. You don't have to fix it. And little by little, we learn. You know, I asked in the evening session that his senior student was sort of did a recap of the teachings of the day, and in some ways it was actually an easier place to go and ask a question. And I asked, you know, like, I'm really new here. I don't really know what's going on with this, you know, way of training. But to me, I'm curious about this handshake practice. Like, it's like basically day one of this retreat, and this is being introduced as the opening. And to me, it seems like a really advanced practice. Like, what about like the stability of mind that you would need in order to be with your experience like that? And the fellow who was the senior student, his name was Scott. He was a good person. He was like, you know, it's a really good point. And he said, you know, I think that Rinpoche has made a decision over the years. He said, this has shifted. In fact, I can't remember. Oh, I think that he said it was a good point. And then later, after the silence was lifted and the retreat was over, I was talking to somebody else and I asked the same question because I was very interested in it. Like, why do you start with this? It seems like something more advanced. And he said, well, Rinpoche changed the order that he was doing things about, you know, 6 or 7 years ago, because that he saw that Westerners were so quick to focus on concentration at the expense, you know, focus on kind of gaining stability of mind at the expense of actually being connected to our feelings. And I really understood and appreciated where that reversal came from, because I feel like I relate to that. You know, it took me a while to circle back around and be like, oh, this is about like being with my feelings and my direct experience. in a concentrated way. Not about like shutting it out or cutting it off, but really being complete, completely intimate. And so, you know, I don't know, it's like a catch-22, because honestly, I think if I had been introduced to handshake practice as my very first, this was an open level retreat, I didn't mention that, so technically you could be a total rank beginner to any kind of meditation and have walked in the door, and this would be your introduction. And I just thought, wow, if I were just being introduced to meditation, I like, you know, rewind the time clock 25 years ago, and like this was the practice, I don't think I would have lasted. Because you really are just sitting there, and whatever, you turn your attention to what you're feeling, and then you handshake that, you be with that. And what was really kind of great was to get this insight into how like another community speaks about practice, because there was Q&A, and people would be like, you know, Rinpoche, I like handshake this, and then I feel great feelings of rage arising. And then Rinpoche would be like, so then you handshake those feelings of great rage. And it was kind of like whatever came up, like the next person would raise their hand and be like, I'm so trying to handshake, but I don't feel anything. I just haven't been feeling anything, and I've been doing this practice for 10 years. And he'd be like, then you handshake that, just the feeling of numbness. So it's like, okay. Which is kind of great, right? It's like we need that. Oh, that's okay. That's okay too. That's okay. Like you're not going to be able to point to any experience that needs to be changed or fixed or gotten rid of. Whatever it is, you just meet it. Gampopa, a Tibetan teacher from about 1,000 years ago in the Mahamudra lineage, said, there is no better method for making progress on the path than not latching on to anything. There is no better method for making progress on the path than not latching on to anything. Non-fixation. I mean, take your pick. The teachings are filled with this instruction, right? The faith mind, the great way is not difficult. Just avoid picking and choosing. Identity of relative and absolute. To be attached to things is illusion. That fixation is just in your mind. It's not real. So, in a practice of non-fixation, you know, when we speak about letting go, it's like important to have correct understanding of what that is, what that means. It's just a way of speaking about non-grasping. And what non-grasping is, we have to find out for ourselves through how we use our mind. So, you know, I think we can think like I'm not supposed to have thoughts, and I'm going to sort of will myself into a thoughtless state. And there are traditions in Buddhism that seem to really emphasize more than we do in Zen the kind of willing yourself into a thought-free state. But my understanding of practice is more that you're seeing what thought is. You know, there's calming the mind and developing samadhi and seeing what the nature of thought is, so that as thought arises, we're not buying into it, but we're allowing it to reveal its empty nature. And so the imprint of ourself is still there. It can still function. It's still like we're going to show up as ourselves, like wherever we go. You know, we have we have a million examples of like different practitioners who are each very much their own selves. Our relationship to that self changes, though. And at the retreat, I you know, I had the opportunity to sort of see myself in a practice community that wasn't this. And that was really like humbling, actually, because I saw like, I saw my beautiful monsters, particularly the one that likes to perform like well and be seen in a certain way. Okay, so, you know, normally like very, very frequently I monitor during Sishin. It's a role I feel comfortable in. I'm happy to do it. I don't have like any longer any sort of like big emotional drama about it. No big deal. And it's been a long time since I've been like usher, you know, or main bell, or sort of had a service position where someone's like working with me on like, do this, not this, you know, faster, slower. And so I sort of thought I was kind of over that. Well, guess what? So at the start of the retreat, there was like this table where you could sign up for different volunteer services. And I was there on a very generous scholarship from both Garrison Institute and Pundarika Foundation, Sogni Rinpoche's foundation. And so I thought, well, I better do some kind of service. And I was like looking at the table and some of the things, I was like, I don't know what that is. It seemed like you would need special training. And I thought, okay. But there was one job to be the mic runner. I was like, I can do that. No one had signed up yet. So I like put my name down for mic runner. There were three slots. And that night after sort of the opening orientation, they were like, okay, you know, the people that signed up for this go here, the people that signed up for that go there. The mic runners come and meet with the audio team. So I like went over to report for duty and got my instructions, you know, very, very simple, like basically like when someone raises their hand and Rinpoche calls on them, like, you go over there with the microphone. Well, I was going to be a fucking great mic runner, let me tell you. And I saw that arising quite quickly in me, and I was, like, a little bit abashed about it. So, like, you know, the retreat's happening. At the beginning of the thing, the audio team, they were really delightful, and they were like, you know, come at the beginning and get your microphone, and then you'll just have it, and you'll be ready when we move into questions. And we each had, like, a section of the room that was our quadrant. And so when it was time to move into questions, I was, like, on high alert. It was like you didn't even need the shadow before I was like whoosh, right there with the microphone. Or that's what I told myself. I felt like, wow, I am really on top of this. And, you know, this went on. I was the mic runner for the whole retreat. So I was like really like getting comfortable with it, you know, so on and so forth. I felt like I could be there with the mic and then disappear. So it was completely not part of the exchange. And I started to think to myself, I saw myself thinking to myself, like, how after the retreat was over and, like, the silence was lifted, I was probably going to, like, joke around with the audio guys about how I should go on tour with them because I was such a great mic runner. No kidding. And I kind of saw what was happening, and I even, in my notes, I was looking through my notes from the retreat because I took a lot of notes, and I saw in the margins twice I had... One place I had, I noticed my tightening, wanting to be good or live up to an idealized version of myself. So I was like, oh, look, there it is. And then in another place, a few pages later, in the margin again, pride, desire to be seen, desire to perform. So I was like seeing what was happening, and it was happening. But the culmination of the whole thing came at the very last night. When the whole thing was over and the woman who was the retreat master was making some closing remarks and she was going through her thank yous, you know, for the retreat. And I'm literally sitting there thinking to myself, like, I hope she doesn't thank the mic runners. Like, that would just be too much, which was a completely ridiculous thought, okay? She's like thanking Rinpoche. Like, the, like, you know... The volunteers that traveled from Colorado, like that thought would even pass through my head was so embarrassing. When I told Gokhan about this, he was laughing so hard. He like, when he gets the giggles in this particular way, he has to pound himself in the heart. So all this to say, like, we cannot help ourselves. We are going to show up as ourselves. The point is not to, like, get rid of that. I mean, right? It's kind of charming. I'm like, oh, that's cute that I was, like, so about that. And you know, I could be tormented by that. So that, again, is, like, what's the difference of view, you know, to see, hold ourselves lightly. And, you know, it's all about what are we seeing? What are we seeing as our view clarifies? What's revealed? In Buddhist studies, I've been looking at this book that has different source material from China, and Buddhism as it sort of first took root in China. And there's this talk, this teaching by Master Huicho of the Linchi school that I don't think I've seen before. It's not very familiar to me, or it wasn't familiar to me at all. But I had read that, you know. He says, this is around 860. If you do not want to be different from the old masters, don't seek outside yourself. The light of purity which shines out of every thought of yours is the Dharma body within you. The light of non-discrimination that shines out of every thought of yours is the body of bliss within you. The light of non-differentiation that shines out of every thought of yours is the transformation body within you. These three bodies are you who are now listening to my talk on the Dharma. It is only by not seeking or pursuing outside that this can have its effect. It is clear that the body of Dharma nature and its ground are but reflections of light. Reverend ones, know and get hold of the person who handles this light, for they are the original source of all the Buddhas and the final abode of truth seekers everywhere. Your bodily makeup of the four elements does not understand how to talk or listen. Nor does the liver, the stomach, the kidneys, or the bladder. Nor does the vacuity of space. Then who understands how to listen? It is the single light which is formless, but very clear before your eyes. It is this that understands how to talk and listen. I have a nephew who's 5 months old. And to be in the presence of a baby is like a window onto, you know, who are we? And he's just in the last short while gotten to the age where he can smile and where he can laugh. And the laughing thing is kind of a mind blower. Because it's like there's just this little, you know, no language, just this little, he's just like learned to hold the bottle. That's like a big deal. And like he has a sense of humor. I'm serious. That's us. That's us. Like right at the beginning, like I'm like, how does he think something's funny? It is. It's like a miracle. And when he smiles, it's like, what? It's like there is light. I was thinking of this. We had a Christmas gathering just before the holidays. And my baby nephew, Miles, was over at my mom and dad's with my brother and his girlfriend and her parents. And it was a really lovely evening. And, you know, of course, everyone was all about, like, the baby. And he was in good spirits and just, like, being adorable. And at the end of the evening, as we were saying goodbye to everyone, we were in the hallway. It's a New York City apartment, very narrow hallway. And so, you know, everyone was getting ready to go out, and, like, Miles was, like, in his little stroller. And so we were, you know, coming to say, one by one, coming down to say, bye, Miles. And, like, he started smiling. And it was just, like, so radiant. It's like that's all that there was just, like, light coming out of him. So joyful. And you'd go down and he'd, like, light up. And then the next person would come and he'd, like, light up. And he was just beaming. And we couldn't believe it. And so you'd, like, want to go back for another hit. And later my mom said, she was like, it was like Darshan. Which, you know, is like in the, maybe I think the Hindu tradition, where you could just go and be in the presence of a divine teacher and feel the love. It was. So whether we are feeling, you know, twisted up or open and loose, we all know that can change either way, and that's not a big deal either. It's learning how to practice, learning how to transform our mind. And so it all becomes grist for the mill, the difficult periods and moments, and those that are easy and relaxed, to not block our heart, to remember our bodhicitta aspiration for ourself, so that we can wake up and so that we can do that for the benefit of all beings. May the precious bodhicitta arise where it has not arisen, and where it has arisen, may it not diminish, but increase further and further.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.